So ultimately, this question, right? Like, what role am I going to play in all this? I hope we can see that that's a tantric question. That's a yogic question. You know, how involved in the world do I want to be? You know, can I be a committed yogi and still be involved in the world? Right? Or alternately, do I step back from the world in order to further realize the self? You know, this is really a basic tenet of Tantra, right? How involved will I be? Most of you know this story well by now, but I'd like to tell it again because it really is one of my favorites, and I think it tells us the most fundamental lesson about Tantra. The story goes, there's a man and a wife. They're both yogis. The man is a classical sort of Patanjali yogi, right? He studies the eight-limbed path, which is mostly about meditation. And the wife is a tantrika. She's a tantra yogi. And every day the husband, he leaves the house and says goodbye to his wife and children and walks up the mountain path and finds his little mountaintop meditation spot. And he sits down and goes into meditation. And at the end of every day, he comes back down and you know, has a meal with his wife and children, and they go on like this. Now, the husband, after a certain period of time, call it 10 years or 50, finds himself one day experiencing a awakening, right? A samadhi. And in this moment, the boundaries between self and other disappear, and he finds himself at one with his entire environment, at one with his own immortality, his own perfection, and the perfection of everything around him in this moment, in every moment, in past, future, and now. And he resides in this samadhi for several minutes before sort of coming back down. And of course, he's filled with excitement at this achievement, right? He's been working his whole life towards it. So he sort of races down the mountain path and rushes back into the house. And he says to his wife, "My darling, I did it. I did it. I found samadhi. All of this work has paid off. I have found samadhi. I was there. I stayed in it. It lingered. It was the most beautiful thing I could ever imagine." And the wife lovingly hugs him. They embrace. They share a big meal together. They make love and celebrate. So the next day, the man rushes back up the mountain path to see if he can discover this place again. And sure enough, he does. Right? He sits in meditation. He does his pranayama. He moves his consciousness here and there. And he finds himself again in samadhi. And this time, he's able to stay for a little bit longer, 10 minutes this time. And he comes back down again, all full of beans. And he's excited. And he tells his wife, "I did it again. I did it again. I can do it." And she's excited for him, and they celebrate, and the children celebrate, and so on and so on. And this keeps going, right, for days and days and weeks and months, where the man keeps going up and finding a way to linger in this place of unity consciousness for a little bit longer each time. Eventually, the reaction he gets from his wife when he comes down the hill is just a little bit diminished each time. Of course, she's still excited for him, but in this beautiful way that only women know how to do, really, she manages to offer pure devotion and love, and at the same time just have this little bit of quietness around it. And finally, one day, the husband says to the wife, "I feel like you're not as excited or as passionate about this process in my evolution as I expected you to be." And this is when the man realizes that the joke is actually on him, because his wife, his own wife, is not the same kind of yogi, right? He's a sort of a classical Patanjali yogi, and she's of the new breed. She's of the tantrikas. And what that means is, her relationship to unity consciousness and the enlightened life is very, very different. So what she says to him is something like this: "My dear, you are as close to enlightenment as the reflection of stars in a pond is from the actual sky. How could you call your experience being enlightened if it was an experience that kept you away from your family, from your wife, from your children, and from your household duties? And this is such an important lesson for all of us, I think, right? Because we start to think, especially on the sort of beginning of the yoga path, we start to think that in order to develop as yogis, we need to renounce, right? We need to step away from the world. We need to give up our relationships, give up our habits, and so on. And we need to kind of go and have the hermit life, right? Maybe if we meditate, maybe if we practice for 10 hours a day, maybe, just maybe, we'll get where we're going. Tantra suggests something different, though. Tantra suggests that perhaps in your experience in the world, there lies potential for awakening. In the washing of the dishes, in the kissing your children goodnight, in the way you treat your husband, in the way you treat your wife, in the way you talk to your friends, in the way you rake the leaves, perhaps there is where your enlightenment lies. So, maybe Tantra suggests that the threshold between the awakened life and the unawakened life is actually a very thin veil. A very thin veil. And so most people hear that and they say, wow, that sounds pretty good, right? That's a lot of good news. It sounds to some people like a bit of a shortcut, right? Like, I don't have to go and give up all this stuff. So maybe Tantra is the easy way, because I can sort of have my cake and eat it too, right? And that's maybe a bit of a falsehood. That's because Tantra, it's not a shortcut, you know? Arguably, it's efficient, and it's a question of using what works, but it's a falsehood that could get people excited. If they think of it as a shortcut, that's not really true, because you could hear all this and you could say, you mean I don't have to give up the world so I can still have sex and eat chocolate and ride motorcycles and still wake up? That's not exactly true. Because the real Tantra, and, you know, we can almost spend a whole session one of these days on what Tantra isn't, and how that word gets thrown around in all sorts of misleading ways. But the real Tantra still involves commitment. Right? It's not a shortcut. It's not the easiest path, right? It still requires devotion and patience and work to succeed. But it does simplify things a lot, because at its heart, Tantra promises us that enlightenment isn't reserved for a select few people, right? Anyone, according to Tantric philosophy, anyone can become a Buddha, a Jesus, a Muhammad, and so on. Anyone. You don't have to be highly educated. You don't have to be physically strong. You don't have to have a lot of money. You don't have to have a 200-hour teacher training or a 500-hour teacher training. It's within reach for all of us. And, you know, this is something that came up for me a lot in my own years of psychedelic experimentation, because as a psychonaut, I ingested everything I could get my hands on in every possible combination. Yeah, I remember my friend Chris asking me in the middle of the night as we were considering mixing one thing with another, and he said, "What do you think that'll do?" And I said, well, there's only one way to find out, right? And what I found was that there were certain psychedelics that would remind me of my own divinity in quite unignorable ways. But what I always found fascinating was that no matter how high I got, I came back down. I always came back down. And that was tough a lot of the time because I'd be out there in the, you know, in the Garden of Eden, recognizing my own immortality and the nature of consciousness and how clearly my experience was creating the world around me. And then that would all start to sort of flow away. And sometimes it would sort of softly fade back. And other times it felt like it was getting torn and ripped out of me as I would sort of return back to sobriety and return back to Earth and return back to my own sort of mortal existence. And that's usually not a very pleasant experience. You can imagine that's why they call it getting high, right? Sooner or later, you come back down and you feel quite low. Terrible Tuesdays. And so I started to think, why is that, right? Like, why do I always end up back here? Well, the simplest solution, if you don't mind applying Occam's razor to this line of inquiry, the simplest solution to why we always end up back here is we always end up back here because here is precisely where we need to be. That is, in order to wake up, this place is where we need to be. Not out there. Not laying on a floor in a dark room on 6 grams of psilocybin. But right here, right now, like you have all of the tools you need right here, right now, to wake up. You don't need to ingest anything. You don't need to meet the right teacher. You don't need any more equipment. You have everything you need. And this is what Tantra is all about. Right? Each person, every person experiencing the now, right? Not indulgence in the senses, right? That can be also another sort of warning sign of a bad interpretation of Tantra, right? It's not a question of indulging in the senses. But it's also not a question of denying the senses. And that's where a lot of classical yoga arguably goes wrong, is that there's this sort of rejection, this renunciation. And that renunciation can lead to a little bit of attraction, actually. That's what happens. The things we shove away, sometimes we empower. So instead of that, the polar opposite would be to indulge in the senses, right? To just let the senses do whatever they want. But Tantra goes a step further. Tantra asks one to look intensely closely at the senses, to observe them and how they affect the mind. So it's not a question of living the same frivolous life that you've already been living. It's a question of conscious living, conscious of your senses, conscious of every moment, as if each moment were your one and only opportunity to be fully alive, fully aware, fully connected to your fully perfect self. So how do we do that, right? The basics are very simple, right? We become aware of energy and how it works, and we manipulate it in very specific ways. Under the guiding principle that it's much easier to move energy than it is to move the mind. The mind, as you have probably learned by now, the mind is very difficult to control, isn't it? Energy, much easier to control. Much easier. And so the image that we so often use in the tantric tradition is this image of Sushumna, Ida, and Pingala. Sushumna is that central energy stream in the body, flowing directly along the spinal cord and often illuminated or illustrated with the images of the chakras. So Sushumna is that central sort of cylinder, and it's intersected by Ida and Pingala nadis, the left and the right, more serpentine channels in the body. These are the ones that crisscross at each of the chakras and find their way all the way up to your nostrils. So the basic image that we hear is that Sushumna Nadi is the central stream along which Kundalini Shakti can move. Now, Shakti is your latent force, your latent, dormant, sleeping potential. And I love the word potential here because it sort of illustrates that all of us have the capability to become great. All of us have potential. Very few of us seem to reach down and summon that potential from within us. Do you know what I mean? Most of you probably have found yourself in moments acting in ways that you look back and you say, wow, like in that moment, I was strong, right? I was strong in the way that I cared for that person, or I was strong in the way that I chose the right word for the right moment, or I was strong in the decision that I made on that day. And you know that on that day, you were sort of fulfilling your potential to become great. So potential is a really key word, because there's also moments where you look back and you say, wow, I probably could have chosen better. Yeah, let's not get into a talk about regret, but you can see the difference, can't you? So, Kundalini Shakti is your potential. And in order for that potential to rise in this image, and it is just an image, but in this image of Sushumna, Ida, and Pingala, Sushumna needs to be straight. It needs to be a clear channel with no blockages in order for Kundalini Shakti to rise. And the continued image that the yogis gave us was that Sushumna Nadi could only open if these two intersecting channels were also open and if they were in balance, in harmony with one another. And so, arguably, this is simply the tantric way of describing the yin and the yang, right? The fact that in order to succeed as awakened beings, we can't just be one-dimensional, right? We need to find a harmony between the soft and the hard, between the feminine and the masculine, between the lunar and the solar. So, what I'd like to do